TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rasching. And Matthew, I have to say, what a coincidence that we both logged into Zoom at the same time today.
You know, I really just kind of do my best, Chris, to make sure that we can be right on time. You know, I'm an on-time person, and it does feel like, though, maybe there's something behind this. I feel like maybe we're both being played by some larger forces at work here. And so I think we should really just get down to the bottom of it.
Yeah, well, I think I know someone who can help us do that.
Ah, Gold Dukat. Yes.
Yeah, that is exactly who I was talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, I believe in coincidences. They happen every day, but I don't always trust them. But I do trust that we're going to have a good discussion today.
Well, you know, history would, I think, prove you right, since we tend to have great discussions.
Speaking of history, I just noticed, got an email yesterday. Someone posted a comment on YouTube on one of our... It's just one of the recent episodes of this show, actually. But they said, hey, wow, is that the real Martok doing the bumper at the beginning of the show? And then they said, nah, I'm sure it's just AI like everything these days. And I was thinking, no, actually, we've been doing this for a long time. And that actually is J.G. Hertzler doing the bumper that he recorded in one of my chats with him. So, yeah. That is him there. Well, everyone, we're going to continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine today with episode 5 of season 2, Cardassians. And here is a quick rundown of the story. A biting boy in the Replimat presents a mystery that leaves Garak's arm in pain and puts the Taylor's suspected spy skills to the test. Teaming up with Bashir, he helps uncover the background behind this young Cardassian wearing a Bajoran earring. The boy turns out to be an orphan, left behind after the occupation and adopted by a Bajoran family. But there is much more to the story than it first seems, and when it's discovered that the boy is actually the son of one of Gul Dukat's opponents, Sisko's decision to allow him to remain on Bajor or be returned to his father becomes all the more difficult. So, Matthew, we get quite a serious story here that lets us delve more into the occupation as well as some important social issues that we deal with here in our own world. But at the very start, we see the return of Andrew Robinson as plain, simple Garak. And while this is just his second appearance, which is actually hard for me to believe when I think about it, I feel like we had seen him again by now, but actually this is only the second time they finally brought him back. But you really can see the potential for the character becoming part of a whole DS9 story right here in the early scene, and especially as they go hunting for the what's going on with the mystery of Rugal.
Yeah, I mean, this is crazy to me because I think one of the interesting parts of this, you know, we've talked to our good friend Una McCormick, who loves Garak, obviously prolific Star Trek author, and it is really interesting that so many of these characters on Deep Space Nine we're so used to them being on the series that we kind of forget they aren't always on the show all the time.
And they weren't a big part of the early parts of the show as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's fascinating. You know, I think it really goes to show the ways in which these characters really connect with you so quickly. And in doing so, they become this indelible part of the show that you don't actually realize that they're not there all the time. And Garrick was definitely one of those characters, and I think quickly became the character that people connected to because, you know, the thing about him is he's intriguing, right? He's interesting. There's a lot going on behind the scenes with this character. And I mean, this episode, I think, does the best job so far of truly kind of showing just how enigmatic this character is.
Right.
You know, this enigmatic Taylor has a lot to offer this show. And I think that's a thing that is incredibly fascinating then. Mm-hmm. Because by creating this mystery around him, who is he? You know, of course, he calls himself a plain, simple Taylor. And yet we absolutely know that's not the case because there's so much more to him. And that's what kind of makes him really fun as a character. And the other part of that too, and this is, I think, the thing that's so interesting. This wouldn't work without Andrew Robinson and his portrayal.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, he's intriguing, but it's, I mean, he's written in an intriguing way, but that alone wouldn't carry it. It's Andy Robinson's ability to portray that intrigue that really makes the character work, right?
Yeah, and which is, it's that thing to which he's so magnetic on screen. Mm-hmm. But the other thing about this is that it's what he brings out with Bashir as a character.
Yeah,
like, exactly. You know, I mean, I think this might be the first time that we kind of see Bashir in a whole new light. Mm-hmm. He isn't just kind of this character that I think people might find annoying. He truly is got a lot of layers to him. And a big part of that is because Garrick brings it out in him. And, you know, that's the way in which, you know, I think Deep Space Nine, as we've talked about in our rewatch, it's continuing to set itself apart from Star Trek The Next Generation. And one of the ways it's doing that is by allowing these different characters to truly be able to kind of, you know, the proverb is iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. And in that way, these characters begin to sharpen one another by knocking off rough edges and kind of refining them into the who they're going to be. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those relationships that will define the show, even though he's only on like 12 or 13 times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, you talk about what he brings out in Bashir, and I think it's very evident here when he's leading Bashir through the bits and pieces and then helping Bashir realize for himself how things may connect together. And sort of the way that Andy Robinson presents those lines and leads him through that, and then the facial expressions through all of that prosthetics as well, really brings this character to life for sure. One thing that, you know, this is the second time that he's on, and one thing that Ira mentioned in The Companion is that they had wanted to bring him back ever since the first appearance, and they just never did. And there were a couple of reasons. And one thing that Ira said is that the first time you can say, well, he's a Taylor, but maybe he's a spy. But you can only do that once.
Right.
You can't keep just playing that alone. So if you bring him back, you have to start fleshing out that idea. And so you need the right story to do it. And then finally, they found that here, especially in contrasting him with Gul Dukat.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the thing, too. When, and because we're still continuing to understand Cardassians, Garrick begins to kind of open the door for Cardassians not to be just this militaristic,
mm-hmm.
but to really kind of bring out the paranoia of Cardassians with the spy side, right? This mm-hmm. idea that there is that they in some ways kind of share a lot with the Romulans in that sense, right? Mm-hmm. They can become very underhanded type of people. It's kind of terrifying. And so that's the other thing that this episode allows us to be able to do is to be able to continue to define who Cardassians are as a people, mm-hmm. but also the differences that we have, you know? So,
yeah. Well, that's the other thing that I really like about this episode is that we've seen a good bit of the Cardassians up to this point, and we've been told a lot about them through the eyes of the Bajorans. But here we actually see through Garrick, like you're mentioning, also through Khotan Pedar, who's the father of Rugal, and then, of course, through Rugal himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dukat, when Dukat comes to the station, we get to see how, you know, multifaceted the Cardassian side of things actually is, and also the point that Gul Dukat makes about the fact that, well, the military was here, they were occupying the planet, he was in charge of the station. We also find out the name right. Terok Nor for the station for the first time mm-hmm. here, but that there was a civilian government on Cardassia that was actually yeah. in control, and that allegedly, I'm doing air quotes here, the military had to follow the orders of the civilian government. And so right. that's why Gul Dukat left the orphans behind when he right. didn't really want to, which of course I'm not so sure that that's
yeah.
what really happened. Right.
Exactly.
But that's what we're presented with in this story. But up to this point, I think we have more of an impression that the Cardassians are just a militaristic race, and they had come and they had taken over Bajor to strip it of its resources and so forth. And so having this idea that there was a clear distinction between the military and the civilian government adds another interesting layer of complexity to the occupation.
Yeah, I think that is something that is a little bit strange when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is actually in some ways a little bit terrifying to kind of think that, okay, this wasn't just a military kind of dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a group of people chose to subjugate another group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I think we kind of get let into the historical illusions for the Cardassians and who they are as a people.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes much stronger, I think, by adding that, because, you know, when you think about this in historically, sadly, you know, Hitler was a duly elected representative yeah. in yeah. Germany, right? Yeah. He won the election. He had every right to be in power. And so that's kind of terrifying. And so to think that for the Cardassians, their choice to then subjugate the Bajoran people was the will of the people. Mm-hmm. Through the government, and then the military exercised that. It's terribly fascinating and terribly terrifying all yeah. at the same time. Like, yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that it was the will of the people for that to be done, but they did elect the government that then did that. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether they were misled, whether they didn't do their homework to find out who they were electing, you know, these things obviously happen. We see it in the world today. But in the end, they lost control.
Yeah.
Or they sanctioned it, one or the other, to subjugate the Bajorans, right?
And that's the thing, too, that I do find interesting. And again, the kind of historical thought process on this is, you know, there had to be people then who knew what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then there also had to be people who are willfully ignorant. Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think of specifically the Germans who lived outside of concentration camps, you know, and never asked any questions. Didn't care mm-hmm. to ask questions about the atrocities that were happening
mm-hmm.
2 miles away from them.
Mm-hmm. Well, we saw that a bit at the end of season one in Duet, right? Where you've got Maritza, who was aware of what was going on. You know, a little bit of that story. So definitely you have people who were aware, who knew what was happening. Not everyone took action or could take action. I think once you let things get too far out of control in a situation like this, it becomes very difficult for anyone to do anything.
Well, I mean, yeah, I do think the interesting part about that with when you take into account Duet, again, we're truly adding to the nuance of the Cardassian people, which is awesome. You know, again, that's the thing that begins to set Deep Space Nine apart, because we are going to break up the monocultures that we've created, which it's difficult to not just see only a monoculture when all you do is hop from planet to planet, like the Next Generation
does.
And that's not
enough time to develop it. Sure.
Right. Not to discount the Next Generation or the fact that it's a great show, but it's just the limitation that then gets set. And and so here, you know, because we're traditionally now the show that doesn't go anywhere, everybody comes to us. You really then get to explore that, which is, again, the point here with Garrick. He truly is just, I mean, one of the best creations on the show, which is crazy, again, to think, because he doesn't have that many appearances in the show.
Right. Yeah. So what was seen as a weakness of the show originally turns out to be a strength of the show and is recognized as one today, I would say.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think it's also the reason, you know, you continue to get people that find the show, and in many ways, because the show mirrors more closely the television to which we are more accustomed to, people, I think, really gravitate towards it. I mean, I know even in watching Star Trek with my wife chronologically, so now we're in the Next Generation. And one of the things that she's really enjoyed about the Next Generation is, even though there isn't a ton of continuity, there is a loose continuity that happens with the characters. But for her, so far, Enterprise was the show that she's really liked the most. And a big part of that is because it's very similar to the type of television that we're all used to now.
Yeah, so. Right. Yeah. Well, continuing on with the occupational hazards, the other thing I like about this story is that whereas up to this point we've heard a lot about the actual resistance to the occupation, the fighting, of course we've heard about how many Bajorans were killed and so forth, but what we haven't really glimpsed yet is the impact of the occupation on completely innocent bystanders. And what this story also does is that the innocent bystanders who were focused on here are actually Cardassians and not Bajorans.
Yeah.
And so I think that it highlights in a realistic way the aftermath of events like this in history, where you have societies in conflict and they become intertwined and there's a lot of loss and suffering and destruction. And when it ends, it doesn't end cleanly. There are always those who suffer long-term impacts from this, and especially children. Anytime you see children caught up in war zones, it's just was heartbreaking to see. And then also knowing how that's going to impact their lives as children, as well as when they grow up, if they're fortunate enough to grow up, is a very, very serious issue to deal with.
And that's a great point that you bring up, Chris, because, you know, one of the other things that we learn about Cardassians here from Rugal's father is this whole idea that orphaned children have no standing in Cardassian culture. Okay, real, like they, how, and I think that's a question that's really interesting that doesn't actually get answered here. But it's like, so what happens to them?
Right.
Does nothing happen to them? Does nobody take care of them? Is there, that is fascinating, because then on top of that, it is such a strange juxtaposition about what we learn about Cardassians, which is Cardassians are like Sicilians in the sense that it's all about family.
Yeah, right.
And yet that seems so foreign from then the way you would treat a child who's most in need. I mean, it's such an interesting dichotomy for this race, which I think what it does then is that as people watching the show, it makes us, I think, have to question, okay, where are the inconsistencies then in our own view of life and how we deal with different situations, different people? And to me, that's another great part of this episode, is that we can sit there and feel like we're in judgment of the way Cardassians might deal with these things. And yet I still have to ask myself, are there places where what I say that I believe shows myself to be completely inconsistent and in some ways like almost hypocritical? That's a fantastic question to have to ask yourself.
Yeah, if it is true that that's how their society works, it is really an interesting question to delve into and figure out what that means. I feel a little bit watching the episode like that statement was put in the script in support of the story just because of Rugal's situation, because it's contradicted within the story. Like you're talking about, everything's about family. And so that part, it doesn't quite connect.
Well, yeah, so I guess I would say in the way it connects is that we see that if everything was about family, then no Cardassian child would have been left on Bajor.
Yeah, right.
And so I think there's this weird way where you're just left with this unease about this culture that has this pride in itself, and yet it's also its own undoing, which is fascinating.
Yeah. The thing that Padar says about family, and he says that in some households, four generations eat around the dinner table together. You know, that's a lot like Japan as well. In Japanese homes, it's very, very common for three or four generations to live together in the same home. So it's sort of a concept that I'm familiar with.
Yeah.
But the idea that orphans, what gets me is that it's what we're talking about here. If you say that nothing is more important than family, then how could you have children who have no standing in society? It seems like if family is that important, you would not want anyone to be without family. So if there were orphans, you would take them in.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And I think that's the kind of brilliant part of the writing of... You can't see the speck in your own eye, but then we get the log in our own eye. And so it's like, that's, I think, the beauty of, and I think one of the pluses of the way in which Deep Space Nine writers create these kind of nuanced, complex discussions of the races involved in the series, but also the way in which they kind of live their lives. Again, it's a reflection of us, and that's kind of terrifying.
So if you believe Gul Dukat in saying that he did not want to leave the orphans behind, but the civilian government told him to leave the orphans behind, if you believe that's true, do you think he wanted to take them back to Cardassia because he knew that if they were orphaned, they would have no standing in society? It doesn't seem like something that he would care about, certainly not at this point, although we do come to know him to be a much more complex character later on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question.
I don't have an answer for you. I don't know what I think.
Yeah, I don't either. I think it is an interesting question. You know, do they leave them there because they believe possibly the Bajorans might even take better care of them? I don't know. In some ways,
or do they want to keep some kind of Cardassian presence in the society, so they leave these children behind?
Yeah. I mean, I think all of this is kind of an interesting question, because there aren't any answers.
Mm-hmm.
And then as viewers of the episode, we're left questioning this race and what really are their priorities mm-hmm. for children and for family. And it makes us feel really uncomfortable about the whole process, especially I think in the thought process that we would be utilizing children as pawns in a political game.
Which
again,
happens.
When they're, yeah. you know, when they're the most vulnerable among us because they cannot take care of themselves, yeah. you know? And that's also, I think, a very scary thing and something to which, unfortunately, I think we see way too often in our own world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, it highlights one of Ira's concerns about the episode, which he has stated is that he was worried that this story might oversimplify a complex issue. And I think that I don't think it oversimplifies it necessarily in the way that you might fear a story like this could, but I think because they don't have enough time to actually address all of the facets of the situation, it leaves us with questions like this. And by doing so, it ultimately does oversimplify a very complex situation.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that it's not necessarily that it's really simplifying it, but I think what it's doing is showing that a situation like this, there truly are no easy answers. And yeah. there are no, yeah. it's not that there aren't correct answers or better answers, but mm-hmm. they're just none of them are going to be easy. And
right.
a big part of this has to do with the way in which you don't do the right thing at the right time. And therefore, it makes the decisions that you have to make down the road much more difficult.
Yeah, exactly. And that was my point when I was mentioning Maritza's situation earlier, that yeah. if you let things get out of control, it becomes very difficult to do yeah. anything because yeah. as individual people, your ability to make a difference becomes less and less and less. And then ultimately, the solution becomes far more difficult. So, about the children left behind, the other thing that's raised in this episode is the idea of culture and identity and blood and the environment that you're raised in, who raises you and so forth. And we see here Rugal, who was adopted. He was raised by what appears to be a loving Bajoran father in a Bajoran family that really cares about him and doesn't care that he's Cardassian. He goes to a Bajoran school, so he learns about the occupation from the Bajoran point of view, which may not be entirely accurate, just because we know how histories are taught in general in the world. But because of his education, he learns the facts about what happened on his new home planet of Bajor, and you know, young people are very insightful and they're not yet attached to various worldviews. And so they can take information about what's happened and maybe see it clearly for themselves. They form their own opinions about it. And he's formed his own opinion about the Cardassians and what they did to the Bajorans, a people that he has come to feel that he is one of. And the point of that is that for him, while he's Cardassian by blood, he grew up on Bajor. He was raised by Bajorans. He clearly sees himself as Bajoran, even though people on the outside don't, because he doesn't look like them. And then to contrast that, we see briefly some of the Cardassian children that are still in the orphanage, and they run out and ask, "Are you here to take us back to Cardassia?" So they seem like they're ready to go back to what they consider their home being Cardassia, whereas Rugal doesn't want to go there because for him, Bajor is his home. So it really starts to talk about how culture and the place that you are raised plays into your identity more so than what your face looks like or what color your skin is or where you were born.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's anybody who's raised children or been around children realizes that you don't have to teach them what's wrong to do, but you have to instill in them a right, what mm-hmm. is right. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, they are very, I mean, kids are sponges, right? They're yeah. soaking up everything. And the fascinating thing about the way in which this situation kind of mirrors then O'Brien and his situation with Cardassians and the way he feels about the Cardassians, you know, he's forced to admit, we can't judge an entire race by the actions of some or many, you know, that doesn't, not everybody's the same in a race. Again, kind of coming back to this idea of, you know, cultures are not mono. There mm-hmm. are multiple variations on themes, you know, and complete opposites in some cultures. So I think that to me is the thing that is incredibly fascinating about this episode, is that we are really dealing with the big questions of what does it mean to raise a child and pass on, you know, your own prejudices and hatreds. Mm-hmm. And is that a good thing? And how helpful is that? Because then you just kind of perpetuate continued violence. I mean, that mm-hmm. that's how you end up with blood feuds between families for generations, you know, and mm-hmm. you see that type of thing throughout history. And
right.
and yeah. so what is also fascinating too about that, right, is that Rugal can't change the fact that he's Cardassian.
Right.
His DNA is always going to be Cardassian. It doesn't matter what they do to him. He is mm-hmm. always going to be that. And so by the way in which you're teaching this young man, you're creating a person who is always going to hate themselves.
Right.
And that's be at thing, war right? with themselves, because
yeah.
there is a thing that like every time he stares in the mirror,
mm-hmm.
he sees the representation yeah. of right. the very thing that all Bajorans hate and would call a butcher, and mm-hmm. there's nothing he can do about it. And so yeah. that's another incredibly fascinating thing mm-hmm. about this episode. And so even though these Bajoran parents say that they love Rugal, I don't doubt that they do.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they're also, what by how they're raising their son, they are irreparably harming him.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, he would always be at war with himself. And that's, I mean, it's, again, it's hard to even, like, find the words for this type of thing, because mm-hmm. it is pretty horrible, actually.
mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's a complex situation, right? The Gul Dukat says that Rugal has been raised to hate his own people. But when I watch the story, I think that, is that true, or is it that simply true, right? Like you say, every time he looks in the mirror, he sees Cardassians. So it's he feels Bajoran. He was raised on Bajor because of what he's been taught in school, which he's going to a Bajoran school. So, you know, he's going to learn about this stuff. But when he looks in the mirror, yeah, it's very different for him than it is for a Bajoran child. Him feeling like an outsider in what he sees as his own world has to have mm-hmm. a strong impact on him. So I think there are a lot of things going on. It's not as simple as what Gul Dukat claims, which is, oh, you know, the Bajorans are just teaching him to hate his own people.
Yeah.
That's a very one-sided and simplistic view of the situation. I mean, talking about how the families you grow up in, their places you grow up can affect you. You know, when I think about myself, I grew up in Alabama in the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, at that time I had family members who would often say things that were quite racist, as you can imagine, in the South. I mean, you're from the South as well, so you know what the environment can be like. And for me, you know, as I got into university, I traveled around the world, and then I moved to Japan when I was 24, and I've been exposed to so many different cultures in my life that, you know, my view of things changed. But I sometimes think that if I had never done any of that stuff and I had just grown up in that family, you know, what would my worldview be like today? It would probably be different than it is now. So those influences definitely do play a role in how people grow up and how biases and hatreds and conflicts are perpetuated, you know, throughout history. I also wanted to mention about Rugal's situation. There's one thing here in Japan that I'm reminded of when we think about how Rugal, he's Cardassian, but he's living on Bajor and people just don't see him. Even O'Brien talking to him, it doesn't occur to O'Brien for a while, right? That or Keiko either, because Keiko prepares Cardassian dishes. Like she completely missed the point that the kid grew up on Bajor and he probably doesn't eat Cardassian food, right? But it's just this assumption that because he looks this way, he's of something else. And this happens in Japan where there's this idea that if you're not purely Japanese, then you're not Japanese and you're not part of society either. And in 2015, Miss Universe Japan was crowned, and she is a woman named Ariana Miyamoto. And she's half Japanese and she's half Black. And I interviewed her for my magazine back then and did a photo shoot and all. She's a wonderful woman. And but she's very Japanese, even though she doesn't really look Japanese. She looks mainly Black, facial features, a little bit Japanese. But she won the pageant. She was crowned Miss Japan. She went to the Miss Universe pageant. But she has said that people don't believe that she's Japanese. Even though if you speak to her, clearly her first language is Japanese. She's much more comfortable speaking Japanese. Her mannerisms, everything about her is Japanese. But she has faced a lot of negativity online and social media, people calling her like she can't represent Japan because she's not Japanese. So, you know, even our own world, we see that where like your appearance determines whether you can be part of the group or not. And you know, I feel when I watch this episode that, you know, it's very much a situation that Rugal faces, that he can never be at home in what he considers his home just because he looks different.
Yeah, I mean, in that sense, you know, when you think about it, regardless of what you look like, if you're raised in a certain culture, you're going to think and act in the thought processes of that culture.
Yeah.
And so you know, you think of children that are adopted around the world, right? And so if you're adopted into an American family from another country, you know, nobody is like, oh, you're not American, right? You know, or vice versa, if you're adopted from another country into, you know, Mexico, Japan, whatever. It's like if you're raised in that culture, that's who you are. And I think that is a really important point then in this episode, because again, though, I think the dangerous part about the story is the way in which, you know, you see poor Rugal, who is being taught to hate a thing he intrinsically can't get rid of because it's literally who he is in that sense. Even though culturally he may be Bajoran, he would always be Cardassian as well. So, and that is, again, you know, I know we mentioned Ira feeling like, oh, we didn't want to dumb this down or make it too easy, or make it feel like there's any kind of easy button in this. Yeah, but I feel like the episode, that the episode really does a good job of just kind of leaving you with this feeling of unease, because there is no easy answer. And where they come down to, you know, even the answer of Rugal going back to be with his father on Cardassia, you can see why they make that decision, but you could also possibly see why they might not make that decision. And I think the deciding factor, and I guess would ask you, is do you think the deciding factor is, and the reason that Sisko would allow Rugal to go back to Cardassia, is because of the nurtured hatred that Rugal has had on Bajor for all Cardassians.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Sisko's decision, it's a very tough one, and I don't know that there is a right decision. And it's also interesting to me that he has to make this decision for this boy when he has a son of his own who's around the same age, it would seem. So as a father, he has to make this decision. I don't think there's any good choice for Rugal, because if Rugal stays on Bajor and he grows up on Bajor, he's never going to have a home there because he's purely Cardassian. He's never going to be accepted by the society, no matter how hard he tries to integrate. He's always going to get pushback from people because not only does he not look like them, but he looks like he is of the race that oppressed them for half a century and right in the immediate aftermath of it. And as he grows up, you know, the next couple of decades, things don't heal that quickly. So he really has no future there. But at the same time, sending him back to Cardassia is going to be an extremely hard situation on him because he really does dislike Cardassians. And I doubt that he would be able to go there and quickly assimilate and shed that hatred and just become a normal Cardassian boy and grow up there. And in fact, that opened the door. You mentioned our friend Una McCormick earlier. She wrote a whole novel called The Neverending Sacrifice that picks up right at the end of this episode and tells the story of Rugal back on Cardassia and the difficulties that he faced in the aftermath of this decision to send him back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't think there was a right decision that could be made here. Either decision that Sisko made would have been difficult for him.
Yeah, I think that was the thing that I actually really loved about the episode too. You know, one of the beauties of this is that we have a story that could only be told on Deep Space Nine because Sisko's a father. And I think that's really awesome because that's one of the most, I think, important parts of Star Trek, right? And in these different series is that when we tell stories in the different series where they can only be told on those series because of the characters and the situations. And so to tell a story where you have to have a father involved in this for it to work. I mean, that's the reason in which both of these fathers look at Sisko and say, we trust you because you're a father. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the decision you're making, we're trusting because you are thinking in the same way we are both thinking. And so, and that is, I think, fascinating because Sisko does make a great point of saying, hey, do you want me in this position? Because I'm also with Starfleet and I've been opposed to Cardassians. Mm-hmm. So can you trust me? Would you trust me to make this decision? He says, no, you're a father. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I understand that you're thinking the same way we both are.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of those places where here in this second season, we're telling a story you could only tell on Deep Space Nine. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think the best Deep Space Nine stories and the best Star Trek stories, I think, for the different series become the ones that you could really only do on that show because of the characters, because of the situation they're in, because of all that kind of stuff. And to me, I love that about this episode. And it kind of creates this emotional connection that we wouldn't have to the story if it was Picard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
Because he would have made a colder decision just analyzing the situation because he doesn't have that fathering experience.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is fantastic. You know, I absolutely love that part of this show. And it also, you know, this episode, you actually don't spend tons of time with Sisko in the episode, mm-hmm. but there's a part of me that almost wishes that we had gotten more opportunities to spend with him in this episode, maybe even just It would have been fascinating to have him have a scene where he's bouncing ideas off of Dax, because, of course, Dax has also been
a good father. Yeah, yeah, true.
And so it almost feels like they kind of missed an opportunity to allow us inside two characters. Mm-hmm. Because we don't actually, and I'll ask you about that on top of this, we don't actually get the rationale behind Sisko's decision, really, in the episode.
Yeah, right, we don't. Yeah, yeah.
And so... do you think that's maybe a detriment to the episode that we don't get a little bit of Sisko's thought process there?
Yeah, maybe, because I'm left feeling like, as much as we talk about the importance of his experience as a father in making the decision, I am left feeling that the decision has a lot to do with politics and the relationship between the Federation and the Cardassians. And Sisko kind of thinking long term about his mission, and that maybe it isn't worth fighting with the Cardassians and Dukat over this particular issue.
Hmm. I think that's an interesting point, because at the end of the episode, when he is discussing this with Padar, you know, he mentioned specifically this idea. Maybe it would be great if, you know, you could mention this and get all those other Cardassian children taken care of. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
And it really does go to show this, as we were kind of talking about at the beginning, this disregard for orphans,
mm-hmm.
which, again, I find to be extremely sad and heartbreaking in the Cardassian culture. You know, this seemed to be more about, for him, the fact that he was able to overcome the political embarrassment as much as it was about getting back his son. And that's where, to me, at the end of the episode, I kind of feel this unease a little bit. And it makes me wish that we had gotten more of Sisko's thought process. And again, I just have to fill in the gaps there where I sense that Sisko believes that the emotional scarring that's going to happen to this young man because of him being raised to kind of hate basically who he is, to be more detrimental than the shock of being relocated and then raised on Cardassia Prime. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this may be the one spot where, as we're talking, where I'm like, yeah, this is the place where the episode almost needed another 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. And if it were made today, maybe we would have gotten that, right?
Exactly. No, I think you're 100% right on that.
Yeah. All right. Well, any other final thoughts, and what's your rating on this one?
This episode is really interesting. And it's one, I think, that is also kind of difficult. It's a difficult rewatch, right? Because mm-hmm. of the elements involved. And I always kind of hate when you see children being in the middle of these type of things. Mm-hmm. It's just never fun, right? I honestly, with, you know, parents who are divorced and stuff, and the conflict that can happen alone, you know, this mm-hmm. type of thing, I can't even imagine as a child what it would be like to go through, right? And, you know, my parents got divorced.
Well, I went through it as a child, so yeah, I know.
So, you know, I was in my 20s when they split up, so it's even mm-hmm. different there, but I still. But this is a really great episode in the sense that what it does for the character of Bashir, which we didn't talk enough about, but I think we create a depth here for Bashir, which is fascinating, because the first time he comes in and says, and just blurts out a question to Gul Dukat.
Yeah, right.
He gets reprimanded. The second time that happens, when he comes in, he has earned Sisko's trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I love that we create this depth for this character and add more to him than just kind of this annoying playboy type of, you know, I just want to be with Dax or mm-hmm. women in general or whatnot. Yes, we really do a lot in this episode for the Bajoran people, for the Cardassian people, for Garak, for Bashir. We do that for, I mean, we get insight into O'Brien. Mm-hmm. This is a great episode in that. Now, I will say the discussion we had there at the very end, I think does show that there could have been more to the episode, but they are limited by the time they have. And so I'm not going to, I'm actually not going to ding the episode because of that, because that's not their fault. There's literally nothing they could do about that. I'm going to go with 4.5 out of 5 Cardassian stews, because I really do think that this is a fantastic episode of the series, and mm-hmm. they do a really good job of dealing with a very complex subject in a way that doesn't leave me overly frustrated that they don't get a chance to dig into every single aspect of it. So, no, this is great stuff, Chris. I think I'm, you know, this isn't an episode I can rewatch all the time, but I really do like this episode, and I think it's really well done. How about you? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, what you talk about with Bashir there, I think shows how, as the series evolves, the writers evolve their ideas, because it has always felt clear to me that the original concept of Bashir was just to carry forward in every Star Trek series, you've got to have some guy who's kind of like the ladies' man, kind of chasing the girls a little bit. And in the Next Generation, that's Riker. And here we've got Bashir. But they evolved this character as the show becomes more complex and richer as well. And so we see that here on display in this episode. And more importantly, the chemistry between Bashir and Garak really sets up, you know, one of the great storylines in all of Star Trek to come up in the coming seasons. And the other thing, like I've said, that I like about the story is that they're addressing the depth of the world that they've created.
Yeah.
And they're like really taking us down into that. And even though they're not able to examine things as thoroughly as we might like, they're certainly making an effort. And talking about the time where they didn't have enough time to do everything in this episode, sometimes we ding episodes because time is wasted on various things where, you know, they could cut something here so that they could give us more about another topic. But in this episode, you know, I don't feel like they're wasting any time. I think they had a subject and they had material that really needed a little bit more time. So yeah, like you say, they really couldn't do anything more than what they did. And I think they pulled off an effective episode. So I'm going to give it 8 glasses of Rokasa juice.
Nice.
All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Cardassians as well. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the easiest way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post for this episode there on the timeline, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. Of course, you can also send us email. If you like, go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to us by email. And you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username everywhere is trekfm. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not biting strangers on the arm, where can people find you?
Well, okay. Well, that's odd. You completely surprised me there. You can find me all over social media, Chris, under the name MattRushing02. You can also find me here on the network outside of all the great Star Trek talk that we're doing on the 602 Club, where we're talking about all of those franchises outside of Star Trek we love. So join us there. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, I've had a couple of shows. One's completed, called Owlpost, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. Over there as well, you'll find me doing aggressive negotiations with the great John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out exactly what goes into that stew, where can people find you?
Yeah, I think I'll just push my bowl to the center of the table and not worry about what's in there.
Smart. That's smart.
But you can find me elsewhere on the network, doing all the shows with you. You can also find me in the back catalog on many shows. You can find me on social media if you'd like to chat there. You can find me everywhere. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. And I'd love to talk to you about Star Trek or whatever over there. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything else we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help to find out how to support the network. Please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your support. So thank you to everyone who is supporting us now. Well, Matthew, I hope you're ready to fly around the room together next time, because we're going to be talking about Malora.
Well, Chris, you know, get your safety belts on. Get your safety belts on. That's all I got to say. Harness up. Be safe. But thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.
I'm just picturing a t-shirt that says harness up, be safe on it.